The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. The date is 26th of March. I'm at Wollongo and Districts RSL with Moisten Hancock, President.
Yes, well, I was born at Lamoureux and left there in about 1962. And came down here to Wollongo. My father was a farmer. And from here I went to work in Adelaide, went to school in Adelaide for a while as well, and then joined the Army in 1968 as a volunteer national serviceman, because I missed out on the call-up. I got a deferral, but I was determined to go, so everybody else was, so I didn't think it was fair that anybody was left out, so I went too. So, and I did my training, Puckapunyu and Singleton, and then Kananga, and then went to Vietnam as a reinforcement and joined the 5th Battalion, who were already there.
What age were you at this point?
Well, I was 19, or 20, no, it must have been 20. Because I was 21 in Vietnam, which was in 1969, so...
You have a slideshow to talk through here.
Yeah, well, this is particularly appropriate to the Battle of Bin Bar. Now, just to explain, the Battle of Bin Bar was... Bin Bar was a little village just north of Nui Dat, which is where our headquarters base camp was, for all the battalions and most of the Australian contingent that was in Vietnam was at Nui Dat. As I said, we'd just finished an op, a pretty big one, and we had various branches of 5RAR had gone off and to do other things. And D Company were left as ready reaction, which meant if there was any immediate problem outside or within our area of responsibility, they were the first to go, followed by B Company if D Company got into strife. We already had, from our platoon, we had one section had gone off on a Tayor night ambush, which Task Force Area of Responsibility ambush. So we were pretty short. Well, during the course of the night, a company of NVA, or North Vietnamese Army regulars, took over the village of Bin Bar. And the next morning, they must have got a bit excited because they opened fire on a tank that was passing, one of our Centurion tanks, and they let fly with a rocket, which didn't do much damage, but it alerted the task force that there was some problem going on in Bin Bar. And at first they thought, oh, there's only a few enemy soldiers in there, we'll clean it out, we'll send D Company to do it. And so D Company took off and got as far as the village of Bin Bar, with the support of the tanks, decided to do a sweep through the village, but suddenly met very strong resistance and pulled back, and then immediately called for help, because they suddenly worked out that this was bigger than just a few enemy soldiers. So it turned out there was probably over 100, well, the body count was 120-odd at the end of the battle, so there was probably 250-odd enemy soldiers in this village by the time you counted everybody and all those that got away and the wounded that they took with them. So B Company immediately got ready, reacted straight away after, and off we went. And there was not much transportation left by the time we got around to taking off. All the APCs and everything had mostly gone, so we were in trucks. So we took off from Nui Dat to do the run down to Bin Bar. And we went straight past Bin Bar and pulled up on the western side of the village, or northwestern side of the village, and the villagers were streaming out and heading off north up the track to try and get away from all the firing that was going on with the D Company trying to penetrate from the east. So it was getting a bit sticky. So we sort of got off our trucks and stood around and tried to filter the civilians that were coming out and making sure there were no enemy soldiers, but that turned out to be pretty well nigh on useless because you couldn't tell a difference half the time anyway. So we waited until the civilian flow had almost stopped and they'd taken off to safety, and then we moved into a bunker, but behind a big mound on the eastern side of the village while D Company moved in from the western side. And of course, with the tanks and 50 caliber machine guns on the tanks and everything, there were lots of overshooting going on, so we were actually bunkered down behind a big bank. That's probably the first photo I took. That's the bank you can see there, and so I'm looking at a photograph of our medic treating a wounded North Vietnamese soldier, and I'm guarding him. I'm guarding him with my camera, somebody said the other day. Anyway, this chap was in the corner of the village in a temple, and Bob Leckie's section had gone into the village, just into that corner to see what was happening, and he surrendered to them. And Bob's section brought him back and dumped him on us, and I guarded him while Bear fixed him up. Now, he wasn't the only prisoner we took at that time. By now, the civilians have all cleared the area. D Company are making a concerted effort to come in to sweep the village, and there's lots of rounds flying everywhere. And another Vietnamese come running out of the village, zigzagging across the paddock and across the road over to where we were. And a couple of people opened up on him and didn't seem to be able to hit him. He was pretty agile, so we took him prisoner. He was a lucky boy. Anyway, we sat there for quite some time and then were asked to move. And we eventually moved on APCs. The second slide I'm showing you now, the rubber behind is where we were on the eastern side of the village. Now we're on the southern side of the village and we're mounted on APCs and we're watching to our left where the village is. And so that's basically B Company all mounted on the APCs. And while we were there, one of the tanks came back, had been badly hit, and they had two wounded. That's the dust-off chopper coming in to take the two wounded out. They ended up in hospital in Vung Tau, probably in 20 minutes' time. Now, while we were waiting there, the manager of the rubber plantation came down in his car with his boss, and they were desperately trying to stop us from knocking down any rubber trees. So he was most concerned about his rubber trees, and the tanks had a habit of running straight over the top of them, but I believe he got compensated so much per rubber tree. This photo is from where we're sitting on the APC, and you can see the dust. That's the village in the background, and that's the gunships coming through. They're Huey gunships with Gatling guns and rockets and whatever else flying through, strafing up the village's houses where the enemy were in the houses. And they did a pretty good job of that. I think there's another one there. You can actually see the chopper in that one. They're just there to the left of that rubber there, over the top of that barrel of that gun, that's where we harboured up during the night, and that's the next story I tell you about what happened at night happened in that piece of the jungle. So we finished up in that piece of the jungle. We got off the APCs and walked over there and set up a harbour just inside the jungle. And so that was a platoon, a four platoon plus company headquarters. There was some new chums as well that had just joined the battalion as reinforcements, and two of them were in our section. So as the sun went down, we'd brewed up and nothing much was happening. D Company had already withdrawn back and were waiting until the next day to start their final push through the village. So they hadn't been able to get through to the other side because it was house-to-house fighting. And so we harboured up for the night, and an APC actually came in and harboured up with us. And we used that APC to do our sentry duty on that night, which is another part of the story. So the sun went down and we had to do sentry, and we were really short on our section, but section commander Jim Corporal, he decided that the two new chums had to get in their hoochie and stay there. They put their little tent up and he said, "You get in that tent and don't you dare come out all night. We don't want to see you outside that tent," because they were new, they had no idea what was going on, and they would have been a liability and someone would have probably shot them by mistake. So that meant we only had about four people to do our sentry, which meant we were doing an hour and a half or 2 hours during the course of the night, which is a long time when you're trying to, you know, get your sleep as well that night. But so Jim and set the sentry up on top of the APC. Our machine gunner, he decided that he liked the APC that much, he went and slept in it with the two tankies. So and they closed the door, and that was the end. They brewed up and had a party, I think. When we set up the APC sentry position, we also put two Claymore mines out in front, about 50 metres out in front, two set looking out. Now, we're in the middle of, well, we're in a rubber plantation, and rubber plantations are notoriously dense at the top. Nothing comes through. It's as black as a dog's guts. You've got no idea. You cannot see your hand in front of your face. But where we were looking, from 50 metres away, it stopped, and outside was clear land, as you could see where the APCs were before. And it was a full moon. So we had a backdrop where we could silhouette, but we couldn't see anything if you turned away from that. It was just so dark. Had trouble finding where we were actually going when we changed sentry or whatever else. So that was the setup. So about, oh, I don't know, about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, it was my turn to go on sentry. The guy that was on sentry come crawling across, and Jim and I had harboured up together, and Dooley woke us up and he said, "There's someone out there." He said, I'm not troppo, there's someone out there." So the three of us were lying, looking out, because he insisted he saw somebody moving out. The only way he could see them was if they were silhouetted against the moon at the back. You couldn't see anything looking back to where the rest of the harbour was. Couldn't see a soul. So anyway, the three of us are lying there, and we're saying, "Nah, I can't see a thing." And there was a bush, and the bush would have been about 10 metres in front of us. And this bush stood up and walked off to the left. And we shit ourselves and did nothing. Not one of us could think we better shoot him or we better do something. We just were shocked that somebody was that close to us, listened to us whispering to each other, and then suddenly stood up and walked away. Well, that put the cat amongst the pigeons, because Jim said, "Well, why don't we do this next sentry together, the two of us on instead of one?" He said, "How do you feel about that?" I said, "Bloody great idea. I don't want to be up there on my own either." So Dooley went and finished his sentry. We duly got up. One of the guys in the middle of the harbour position swears that that scout actually fell over him where he was sleeping. And Jock said, "I didn't know who it was, So I couldn't do anything. But this person fell over me, but then I realised later that no one was changing sentries or anything. So it must have been the scout. He's walked right through the middle of our harbour. So he went off that way and we got the starlight scope out and tried to see and whatever. Couldn't see anything anyway. So Jim and I are sitting on the top of the APC. And I'm looking out this way, Jim's looking that way, and all of a sudden I see two people moving in right towards us, straight in from out the clearing, silhouetted. I can only see them because I was silhouetted by the moon. And those two have walked straight in. They were walking, you know, 10 steps and they'd stop and listen, and they'd walk another 10 steps and stop and listen. So I've tapped Jim on the shoulder and we've grabbed the Claymore Mine clackers, and we waited and waited until they were virtually sitting on top of the Claymore Mines. Then we went bang, let them both off at the same time. And this bloody great big black cloud lit up with the explosion, sticks and dirt and whatever else, because the Claymores weren't that far away. They were a lot closer than they should have been, because we were always scared that the Nogs would find them if they were too far out and turn them around and face the wrong way. So anyway, this boom. And when things stopped falling out of the sky, we sort of jumped off the back of the APC. Well, the guys in the APC, like our machine gunner and the two armoured guys, were still asleep. They, even though this explosion had gone off, they hadn't heard it, that didn't wake you up, which is normal, actually, when you think about it. It's not the first explosion that wakes you up, it's the second one. Because the first one, you make out, oh, I didn't really hear that, did I? And then the second one, you said, yeah, shit, I did hear it. So I'm banging on the door trying to get the machine gunner out in case we need the machine gun, because he's inside the back of the APC. The next minute, the APC corporal gets up. What's going on? He's got twin 30 caliber machine guns on his turret. And out the front where these two bodies are, one of them's made a bit of a death rattle, or made a sound anyway. So the tankie decides he's better open up with the twin 30 caliber machine gun. So he's got them on maximum depression, which means they're pointing down like that, and he's let fly. And the rounds are going straight on the ground, bouncing straight up, and there's red traces flying everywhere until the guns jam. They both jam. And then our machine gunner finally woke up and got out of the APC. And he decides, oh, he might have heard something too, so he gets his M60 machine gun and gives that a spray, right? So in the end, all three of them decided that, oh, they killed two blokes. You know. It was all them. It wasn't anything to do with us, with the Claymore Mines, which is bullshit, but still. So we spent the rest of the night up there, sort of all on tender hooks. Next morning, we found the two bodies. They were NVA soldiers dressed in uniform. The belt buckle over there and the thing that was came off one of the bodies, along with a cigarette lighter that's next to it, souvenirs that were taken off the body by myself. But just before the sun came up, there was another contact to our right with 6th Platoon. They had a bit of a contact with some troops that were moving, enemy troops that were moving around as well. We finished up, the sun came up, we had breakfast. A couple of guys had to dig a hole and bury the two bodies. And while we're having breakfast, somebody looked up and said, who are those blokes down the other end of the jungle to our west? There's a whole group of fellas down there. Yeah, there is too. There's a whole group of fellas down there. And they're moving across our front through the rubber. And somebody says, they must be enemy. No, they're waving to us. And then suddenly the penny dropped. They were the enemy, and they thought we were part of their group. So our platoon commander, Moose, says, get the machine gun going. Well, one of our corporals had decided it was time to take a crap. So he's gone straight out in front of the machine gun, which is probably not a bad idea normally, and he's trying to, as Barry Ryan says, and he strangled it, whatever, and he couldn't move. So we can't open up, and we got these dudes. In the end, we got him back in, we opened up, they opened up, and we've got a firefight going. So Moose says, I've got to go and get the, I've got to go and get the Centurion tank. It's just over there. We'll get the tank and we'll do a sweep through and we'll get behind the tank. So the tank turns up. That's the tank. So, and that guy, the guy on top there is called, his name's Joe Dizek. And that was his second tour of Vietnam, driving a tank. Anyway, the tank was sort of idling just outside the rubber. And Moose and I rushed around to try and get the tank driver's attention. So Moose goes to the back of the tank where there's a telephone. And he's grabbed the telephone and he's winding the knob and no one answers. And they're inside with the catch down. And Moose reckons later, oh, they must have been having a cup of tea. So he pulls the phone off and throws that away. He jumps up on the back of the tank and he wanks on the turret. And then when nothing happened, he's let fire a couple of rounds over the top of the tank's turret because the engine's going and they can't hear us. Mm-hmm. Next minute, Joe's head pops out. Moose is saying, have a look over here, get there. So Joe had to get clearance from his boss to move his tank into any position at all. So that took a bit of time. Well, we finally got going and there's a bit of a firefight going on between the rest of the troops that are still on the ground. Then the tank moved into the jungle, as you can see, and away we went. And I'm following along behind this bloody tank. I figure the safest place in the world is to get behind a tank. As it turned out, it wasn't, because the Noggies out the front, North Vietnamese, had a 157mm recoilless rifle, which is a thing that can blow a hole straight through a tank like that. But fortunately, they dropped it in their hurry to either get away or whatever, and we actually captured it. But when we showed Joe shit himself. He said that thing would have taken me right out. So as I'm following along behind Joe, I can't hear because of the engine, and I'm following along. Joe's just here next to me with the tank, and he sees a hole in the ground over there, and he says, grenade, pulls out a grenade and throws it. Well, I didn't hear him say grenade. I'm just standing here. The hole's there, you know, like about 5 metres away. And fortunately, the grenade went down the hole and exploded. Otherwise, I would have been right in the shrapnel zone. But Joe couldn't see me. I couldn't hear him. And fortunately, he had a very good arm and it went down the hole. So anyway, we continued the sweep through the rubber. And the North Vietnamese, or whoever they were, took off. There would have been probably 50, 60 of them in the group, and quickly bailed out when they realised a couple of these high explosive shells landed in amongst them. And so that finished our morning off. So we sort of retired a little bit and waited and acted as a blocking force while D Company did their last sweep through the village. Once again, they came in from the east and they went right through the village and they got right to the end of it and they cleared the whole village out. So while that was happening, the NVA decided that they would retreat, basically, those that were left of them. So they went to a little place just next door to Binh Ba called Duc Trung. And that was where a lot of the civilians had gone to and whatever. It was where the factory for the rubber plantation and all that was, Duc Trung. So we had to clear that as well. So here we were on the other side of Binh Ba village, lined up to attack Duc Trung. Now, there is a famous photo taken by the war correspondent of 6th Platoon behind the APCs attacking Duc Trung, and we followed 6th Platoon from there. So that's us lined up waiting for the go to get started on it all. Then off we went. Well, we got about halfway across to Duc Trung, which was only probably a mile away, and we were halted and told to return to the start line. So we pulled back because they feared that there were civilians in Duc Trung and we wouldn't have been able to have identified who was who. So there was a group of provisional service soldiers around as well. This is the view of Duck Trang from where we were. And then the provisional soldiers came through on our left and went through to Duck Trang. By the time they got there, there was nobody there anyway, so it didn't really matter much. But you can see by the pretty casual way the provisional boys are going, they don't really want to know about it. And they'll get there just slow enough so that everybody's gone, so then they'll all be okay. That self-preservation was a great art. That's the school building in Duck Trang, which had taken a bit of flak. So we stopped probably about there. The enemy had gone, basically. They'd taken off north. We finished up staying the night in the rubber on that side of the village just to make sure. And then the next morning we gathered back on the eastern side of the village and waited for the trucks to come and pick us up and take us back to camp. That was our Binbar story. That it was quite a notable battle. I think I went back later with the Civil Defence Forces because we helped the civilians and we were feeding them and all that and trying to compensate them for damage to their houses and all that sort of stuff. So I think in the end we found 120 NVA bodies, heaps and heaps of weapons, and most of that was what D Company and the tanks and the gunships had done, rather than what we had done. So that was the Battle of Binbar. So we came back, that was 5th and 6th of June. I might just go on and tell you about my 21st birthday, because that's quite significant, because on the 15th of June we started another operation around the Long Hai Mountains, which were south of Nui Dat. A day that sticks in my mind, or a night that sticks in my mind, particularly because it was my 21st birthday. So it was the 18th of June. We were ambushing in a paddy field. We had a big paddy field all around us, and there were tracks that go through the paddy field on the banks, or the buns. Intelligence had said that the river, which was about a kilometre or two away, was going to have a supply of weapons for the Viet Cong arrive that night, and there would be a porter party that would go and unload them and take them back and hide them somewhere. So we ambushed on this area which had a big bank of sand and that for building buns and whatever else, and quite a large open area, and we put our three machine guns out and whatever. So about 10 o'clock that night, a light appeared into our ambush position, and the guy on the machine gun at the back opened up, and then the light disappeared and nothing more was heard, and we just let it lie, because there's not much you can do in the middle of the night. So then about an hour later, another light came down on our side, and we blew the claymores, I think, on that, and there was a gentleman who shouldn't have been there, because after curfew, no one's allowed out after 6 o'clock unless you've got other things on your mind that you shouldn't have. Then about 12 o'clock midnight, a whole line of lights started coming up from the river and across our front, about 200 metres away. And it was obviously a pretty big porter party. And it would have been about 11:45, I reckon it was. And this party came across our front. Now, we're a bit far away, but Moose called in the flares through the artillery, and when they got opposite us, he called the flares in. The flares dropped, and we opened up with our machine guns. Now, it was nearly 12 o'clock, and I said to Jim, my section commander, I said, "I'm out of here." And he said, "What do you mean you're out of here?" I said, "See that big mound there? I'm going to sit behind that." I said, "There's no way I'm going to get shot on my 21st birthday, right? So if you want me, that's where I am." Anyway, I'm sitting behind there, and Jim yelled out, "Mo, we need the bloody Armalite." because the guys had moved the guns really quickly and they'd forgotten to put down any decent cloth or canvas to protect the rounds as they were dragged in, and the silicon on the sand had blocked all the machine guns up. And they were desperately trying to clean their guns. And I had an Armalite, which was an automatic weapon, so we went down and fired a couple of shots. I've got a photo at home actually taken that day of my 21st birthday, because it was the same day we lost one of our bird dog. Bird dog was a guy on an aeroplane who flew around and spotted for the artillery. Not in a chopper, in an aeroplane. And the next day, we obviously spent the day catching up on our sleep, but not there. We moved off somewhere else and then stayed there for 2 days. And I'm just sitting there looking up. I'm writing a letter, I think, and looking up. I hear bird dog, and the mountains are in the background, and they're shelling the mountains. And all of a sudden, the plane's engine stopped. I thought, well, that's a bit funny, isn't it? And I've looked up and I can see this Aralyn coming down like that, just flapping down. I thought, bloody hell, that's even funnier. Well, it turned out he got hit by one of our own shells and knocked out of the sky. So I actually saw the plane. I didn't see the plane hit the ground, but I saw part of it. That obviously it had broken up in the air, hit the ground. So that was the 18th of June 1969, my 21st birthday. So they're about probably the two most significant things that happened in my time. I finished up on the 18th of August 1969. I was wounded, attacking a bloody bunker system of some description. I don't know what it was, but it wasn't a serious wound. I spent 3 weeks in hospital, and when I came out, I went to Saigon as the ambassador's bodyguard, the Australian ambassador, and spent quite a bit of time in Saigon, which was a breeze. Lived in a hotel, had extra $5 a day, had to buy all our own food and whatever else, which was the extra $5 a day, which was plenty. You buy a decent T-bone steak for a dollar. And I stayed there with a few other guys who'd been bush, come out, and then they worked out that we weren't really meant for that sort of thing because we'd been bush too long. We didn't like but taking orders. We used to get in a lot of trouble. So they sent us back to Nui Dat and replaced us, and I only had a month left to go in country. And that meant I was too short to go back in the bush with another battalion because Fiver had already gone home by then. So I finished up my last month in country. I washed dishes at the reinforcement wing, which was a great job. Had lots of chalky milk and plenty to eat and loved it. And then I came home after that. So that's probably about it. Yeah, no, they are quite vivid memories. I think of them a lot, actually. So you ended up in rubber plantations all the time, no matter where you went. Right. Really, either that, it was a banana plantation or it was something like that. It was scattered all around Phuc Thuy province. There were some, the Battle of Long Tam was in the middle of a rubber plantation in 1966. So we were basically surrounded by rubber plantations, but not all of our areas of operations were within rubber plantations. Some were up in the mountains, like the Long Highs or the Tui Ngai Vais, or a couple of times we went further north up into around where the Yanks were, close to our northern border of Phuc Thuy province. We were actually, Phuc Thuy province was our area of responsibility, and we looked after that without any help from anybody else, because other people operate in different manners and the American method of operation didn't really suit our method of operation. They had a fairly callous regard for life, whereas we all tried to preserve ours. It didn't pay to operate too much with the Yanks, really. They were a great bunch. And if you ever got into trouble, you'd call the Yanks, dust offs and things like that, guys that were wounded. If we were under fire, our own RWF wouldn't fly in until such time as it was safe. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Yanks didn't care. They'd just fly in and get you out regardless of what was going on. They didn't give a shit. They were fantastic. Yeah, we'd never knock a Yank, because just never know when you might need them. The thing I do need to mention too is there were two companies, D Company, who did the house-to-house fighting, and B Company. So it is important. D Company, rightly so, get most of the credit for Bin Bar, but there was a lot of action around B Company as well, which often hasn't been mentioned that much. But and there's lots of photos on the 5RR website, and there are some more stories on there about Bin Bar too. I was pretty lucky, really. In my experience in Vietnam, not many people were able to go to Saigon like I did and unwind. Whereas, you know, after 6 months in the bush, I was nearly bloody head-fucked anyway. I can understand how guys who did the whole 12 months and did it all in the bush, you know, came back a different person. But I was very lucky in that I had the opportunity to get a decent old wound that was $1 million wound, I called it. It meant I didn't have to go bush anymore, and I could go to Saigon and have a ball. Basically never... The only shot I ever heard fired in anger was when the gardener's son tried to jump into the Australian residence fence one night without letting anybody know, and somebody tried to shoot him and missed. Other than that, it was very quiet in Saigon.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.